certain members of the committee left the meeting that we will proceed with the work of the committee in line with the resolution from the National Assembly to report back to it by the 24th of October in the task that has been given to us. And we will continue doing so as long as the meeting quorates. So today is then a continuation of what we were engaging in last Thursday and Friday. I'm now on item 3 on the agenda, which is the consideration and adoption of the agenda. Are there any additional items that you want to move, honourable members, in terms of the agenda? If not, can somebody move the adoption thereof? The Honourable Maseko, seconded by the Honourable Dlakude. I now go to, firstly, the set of minutes for the 25th of September 2014. And honourable members, those minutes are in your possession. I want you to, firstly, with me check the correctness of these minutes before we deal with the detail in there. On page 1, are there any corrections? Page 1, any corrections? It's basically the attendance by the members. All surnames spelled correctly. Page 2, any corrections? Page 3, any corrections? Page 4, any corrections?
Just if you can move slowly, unfortunately, because the minutes were not
ready. I can't hear you, Honourable Member. Can you just speak into the mic?
My apologies, Chairperson. I was requesting that if you would move slowly, because we're still trying to go through.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the minutes were not secured, so it becomes difficult if you're moving faster.
Okay, what I'll do is I'll give you a few minutes then, just to read through the minutes, and then I'll go back so that we consider it page by page for corrections.
I'm going to go to the next one.
members, are you now in a position to proceed? I was told by the committee secretary that the minutes were indeed distributed this morning.
Chairperson.
In future, I would request
these
minutes to be distributed earlier. Yes.
Sorry, Chairperson, just on a point of order, I think the gentleman there reading a newspaper in our meeting is really disturbing. I think if he needs to read a newspaper, he should do that outside.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you are aware, the area where even the media is sitting now is actually for members of parliament and their support staff. Usually members of the media are sitting behind, not really being too particular as far as that is concerned, but just let us conduct our work in a way that doesn't distract the attention of the members of the committee from the work that is at hand. I also, earlier this morning, and the photographer politely agreed to it, who was sitting right here and taking photographs over years, asked him to use the space at the back and the other ones on the sides to conduct his work from. So let us cooperate and agree to proceed in such a way that none of us distract the meeting from raising newspapers and all those type of things. It's not going to assist us. So I make the request to the gentleman in the blue sitting in front, just to abide by cooperating with us. To you, sir. So, you didn't follow what I said, sir? Didn't you follow what I was saying? No, I just said, don't lift your newspaper so high. The members are saying that it is distracting. Sir, I'm not communicating and engaging in an exchange with you. I'm just saying you may read whatever you want to read, but let us not distract the meeting from whatever is there. Honourable members, I now go back to the minutes of the meeting of the 25th of September. Page 1, corrections. Page 2, are there any corrections? Page 3, are there any corrections? Page 4, are there any corrections? And page 5, are there any corrections? There's no corrections. Can I get a member to propose the adoption of the minutes as a true reflection of the meeting that happened on the 25th?
I move, Chairperson.
Moved by the Honourable Maseko and seconded by the Honourable Ngobo. Are there any matters arising on the minutes of the 25th of September? Yes, Honourable Kubai.
Yes, Chairperson, there's just, let me just quickly go to the page 3. It's also still under matters arising. I'm not so sure if this was sorted out, where there was a request for additional documents to be sourced so that our records clearly displays once it has been. Because it looks that it's under paragraph 5.1. So we've got to have quite clear records that has been done. Thanks.
Okay, the secretary was not provided with that list of documents that was requested, Honorable Kubai, so we could not act on it. Are there any additional matters arising? Are there any additional matters arising? There's no further matters arising. I will then go to the minutes of the 26th of September. 25th September, okay. Matter arising on the 25th? Yes.
Chairperson, I want to refer you to paragraph 6.2 and suggest with respect that there's a matter that has got to be laid to rest. And this is a matter that was discussed at great length, raised by Honorable Maimane, who maintained that the Public Protector's report contained remedial actions that must be followed because they are not merely recommendations. And I want to indicate that those that saw the judge for yourself by Professor Dennis, will have heard that the public protector herself conceded that her findings were not bindings, they were recommendations. And I want to lay down, lay this matter to rest in the following words, if you permit me, Honorable Chairperson. Chairperson, the opposition argued that to take remedial actions means that such remedial actions are binding on the executive and parliament. In my view, any interpretation of the phrase take remedial action must be based on the mandate of Chapter 9 institutions, namely to strengthen and support our constitutional democracy. This can be best achieved by determining the desired remedies and recommendations and recommending them to the appropriate state institutions, because Chapter 9 institutions cannot have overriding powers over all three arms of the state that they are mandated to strengthen and support. Such a situation would be absurd. I do not believe that the intention of the Constitution and the Public Protectors Act is to create an adversarial relationship between the public protector on the one side and the executive and parliament on the other side. This would be costly because it would allow the public protector to appoint and dismiss staff in government departments, formulate the rules of parliament, and exclude the jurisdiction of parliament in certain matters. This would be absurd. I do not believe that the Constitution and the Public Protectors Act envisage such absurdity. I maintain, Chairperson, that the remedial actions taken by the public protector are not binding on Parliament, because if it were so, it would mean that the public protector has curtailed the jurisdiction of Parliament. I thank you.
Are there any further comment? There's no further comment. And we will proceed to the minutes of the 26th of September. Have the honourable members read those minutes of the 26th of September, which was basically a continuation? You will recall there was a request late on Thursday evening by the honourable Maimane for us to suspend proceedings and to continue in the morning. So the minutes that is there in front of you is a continuation of the discussions that occurred on the 25th of September. I'll once again first check the minutes for correctness. Page 1. Are there any corrections? Page 2, are there any corrections? Page 3, yes, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chairperson. Page 3 on 5.3, where it just start by saying the majority party responded as follows. I think as it stated in 5.2, must state Honourable Dlakude.
The Honourable Dlakude on behalf of the majority.
Of the majority.
We'll make that correction. The Green. Are there any further corrections? Page 4. No further corrections. Can I have a member moving the adoption of these minutes? Yes,
just
Honourable Kobay.
Page 4, Chairperson. Paragraph 5.11 speaks. I think it needs to stipulate that the opposition parties left the meeting, walked out, and withdrew their participation, because they didn't withdraw their participation from the committee, but they withdraw from the day's proceedings and also from the participation. I think it needs to be stipulated correctly, because as it is, it's not clearly stipulated, like they said throughout the meeting. Thanks.
Okay, we'll make that correction, agreement on that. minutes having been corrected, can a member move for the adoption of these minutes?
As well. Because immediately after the withdrawal, there were discussions in the committee, and there were agreements in terms of how to proceed and all that, which does not reflect in the report. If you read the minutes, you would assume that immediately the withdrawal, the committee had a quorum, but then just closed the meeting. I think there should be some paragraph. I can't remember what was. I would have to go to my notes. But there were extensive discussions thereafter, because I remember Honorable Tlakude made some inputs and other colleagues that were there made some comments and before the meeting can close.
Okay.
I would request that the activities immediately after the walkout is reflected properly.
Okay, let's do the following. I will give the committee section an opportunity to go and consult the transcript of the meeting and then complete that indeed, Honorable Kubai, you are correct, that there was further participation in the meeting after the members of the opposition decided to walk out, and it needs to be reflected in the minutes. We will consider these minutes after lunchtime. The minutes of the 26th will be considered after lunchtime once those issues have been clarified. Honourable members, I now want to get into the agenda for the meeting for today, which essentially was saying that we must start looking at the recommendations that this committee must make. However, in my capacity of the chairperson, I've decided to request the content advisors from Parliament to make an input into the meeting. In the discussions over the 2 days that has taken place, there were a lot more emphasis on certain reports and less on other reports. And I've tasked them to look at where are these reports in fact saying the same thing? Where are the commonalities in these reports? What are the divergent points in the report? So that as we move into making recommendations, firstly findings and then recommendations, we are appraised of the work that has been done by them. I've also asked the content advisor that's working with the Portfolio Committee on Police to do exactly the same as far as the SIU is concerned, because there's been a lot of reference to the SIU and what the SIU is saying, what the SIU can do, cannot do, and so forth, so that we have clarity of purpose before we even start looking at the recommendations. Is there any disagreement with this approach, Honourable Members? I will now, thank you, Honourable Members. I will now ask the content advisor that was tasked to look into the areas of commonalities, divergent views, and so forth, to take us through the report, and thereafter we will open it up for further discussion, and then we'll ask the content advisor of police to do exactly the same. Can we start with the first one, please?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members, Chairperson. I was tasked to look at and to put something together on the commonalities and differences specifically between the two reports that were discussed over the last few meetings of the committee, that being specifically the Public Protector's report and the report of the Special Investigation Unit on security improvements to the President's private residence at Nkandla. Chair, maybe there's a precursor needed about the two reports before we look at the specific commonalities and differences between the two reports. The first is that as soon as we compare reports that emanate from the work of different agencies and structures of government, it has to be done with a very firm understanding that they cannot be expected to reach the same conclusions. That would merely indicate that something does not seem right. Secondly, structures and agencies that carries out investigations of this nature will come to different conclusions because they are constituted with different objectives in mind. And these divergent and different objectives are described in each one of these institutions and agencies' legal and statutory frameworks that guide their work. And we need to keep in mind, fourthly, that these types of divergent objectives very often suggest a particular methodology based on that statutory framework, and therefore influence the outcomes of such investigations. But it's important that to remember that in spite of the fact that they have different statutory frameworks, these agencies and structures are constituted in line with one founding document called the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. So they will have commonalities as well. A comparison of the conclusions, or a comparison of the reports and then its conclusions, should therefore not be done in a way to separate and cast aspersions on any of the institutions, structures, or agencies. A comparison only serves to assist with clarifying the inevitable matters of complexities that this committee has to deal with. Chair, I get to a stage where I have to just list matters of complexity that is of concern for this ad hoc committee. The first matter is that of the particular project that is under discussion. And it's the matter of which statutory and legal measure guided the project. Now, I'm hesitating here, Chair, because I realize and we have to keep in mind that there is a third agency and a third report, which at a later stage, if chairperson instruct, we can look specifically at. I want to just make it clear that we're looking at only, again, public protector and special investigation units reports. Having paused, for the public protector, the statutory and legal measure that guided this project is the National Key Point Act. And there's specific reference in that report to the declaration of cost that the Minister of Police should, at a particular stage of kickstarting this project, should hand to the President. And there is a to and fro between different offices that Key Point Act stipulates, my apologies, should be followed. So the public protector places huge focus on that act and its schedules. For the special investigation unit, it is Cabinet Memorandum 2003. The special investigation, in addition to Cabinet Memorandum 2003, gives specific attention to the Public Finance Management Act, National Treasury Regulations, National Treasury Regulations Practice Notes, and importantly, the Implementing Department, Department of Public Works, its specific supply chain management policies. The second matter of complexity that is of concern is the matter of costing. For the public protector, the president had to sign, had to accept, consider, accept, and sign off on the declaration of cost that the Minister of Police had to hand to the president. Again, as per the National Key Points Act. The public protector places substantial emphasis on, in addition to that, an internal document that apportions cost to, on the one hand, the state, and the other hand, the president. The actual document, actual internal document that is referred to, has not been found. But what is of evidence is a costing that is done in the public protector's report, and that costing was done by the private quantity surveyor RNG consultants. We go to the SIU. The SIU, because of its focus on Cabinet Memorandum 2003 and its focus on the PFMA, Treasury regulations and practice notes, and the supply chain management processes and policies of the Department of Public Works, refers to the specific cost for the project as drawn from the budget of the implementing department. So costing falls within the department that has to implement. And whatever is done there has to follow PFMA strictly. It has to follow national treasury regulations strictly, and supply chain management, and whatever other policies that department has in place to ensure proper financial expenditure. Now, an important aspect in this regard is that the Department of Public Works is, and both reports share this. If the costing falls within the Department of Public Works and it gets drawn from there, both the public protector, in spite of the focus being on National Key Points Act by the public protector, her evidence and her report clearly shares this commonality with the SIU report, and that is that the professional team of the Department of Public Works, that means its senior architects, its senior quantity surveyors, and its structural, civil, and electrical engineers, were slowly but surely during the duration from start to the where we are right now with the project, they have been removed slowly but surely. Therefore, the type of amount we are talking about comes from the private professional team, and the costing as per Makanya Architects and RNG Consultants, as led by the principal agent, Mr. Makanya. This shifted the responsibility for costing and the escalation of costs to the private professional team and its leader. Now, a comparative reading of the reports show that the matter of costing can only be properly looked at with an understanding of and a focus on the actual contracting between the Department of Public Works and the principal agent. And this is not because of the Special Investigation Unit report stating so, it's because the Public Protector's report also, in spite of her focus on National Key Points Act, has to concede that that matter places the focus on that contracting. So, Chair, as I said as a precursor, there would be differences because of each of these institutions / agencies' different legal and statutory measures that put them in place, but the commonalities will be drawn at a particular stage because they are founded by the same constitution that gives us specific acts such as the Public Finance Management Act and others that ensures that when we work with state money, we work and do so properly. And that, I would suggest, is the reason why those two reports come together on the matter of that contracting. I now deal with further commonalities that's found. One of them is that the Department of Public Works, the National Defence Force, and the SA Police Service staff did not follow the statutory and legal measures along which this president's private residence had to be secured. Did not follow statutory and legal measures as per what is on our statutory statutes. Secondly, the Public Protector and the SIU reports are in agreement that this was contrary to the regulatory framework of Treasury and the supply chain management policy of the implementing department. The Public Protector report and the SIU report has a slight difference of focus when it comes to this. Public Protector report does not refer specifically and with enough emphasis on DPW's roster administration system, while SIU goes very sharply into that divergence, the diverting of let's not follow the roster system when we appoint consultants. And we may see the reason why when we look at the SIU Act and what it states the SIU should do. The SIU further focuses on both National Treasury regulatory framework, DPW's supply chain management policy, as well as the roster system. So there's that slight shift of focus between the two. But both reports, as I mentioned, agrees that the regulatory framework and SEM was not complied with. So it results in Makanya Architects, RNG Consultants, as a combination, doing the design and costing on behalf of, and as if they were in fact, a professional team of the Department of Public Works. This process of handing over cost control to private consultants started, and the date is shared by both reports. It started with a request by the project manager of Public Works, dated 1 September 2009. Makanya and RNG was then appointed to ensure complete integration. That word is always there. The word integration and merge, as far as this is concerned, is always in both reports. Between private and public renovations that had to be effected. By 11 September 2009, this private architect and the private quantity surveyors, with Ibongo as structural and civil engineers, and later in October, November 2009, Igoda, as electrical engineers, became the team that effected all the work. The handover of costing to the private professional team lies at the core of the escalation of cost of the project. And in both reports, there are tables that list how that cost escalated over 11 costing exercises by RNG consultants. The only cost we see from the Department of Public Works is the initial cost of that was done without security measures being checked by SANDF and SAPS. And then a final one, I think. The public protector and the SIU agree that non-compliance, and I've been saying that more than once, Chair, they agree that non-compliance with our regulations and our statutes lies at the heart of the project. Chair, let me, if you allow me, to just go through other differences. As I said, my apologies. The first difference inherent in this, in these reports, is the origin of the investigation, of each investigation. SIU investigation was directed by Proclamation R59 of 2013. It directed the SIU to, number one, investigate the validity of processes used to engage consultants and contractors who installed the security upgrades. And secondly, it directed the SIU to look at the payments that were made to them. In addition to that, if the proclamation stated that, in addition to that, the Act directs the SIU to take disciplinary steps to prosecute and to institute civil proceedings where they are relevant. Those are very important, and my colleague will go further through the SIU Act later on and lift more of those up. The public protector, on the other hand, responded to complaints from the public, and these were listed in a report as 12 aspects, which makes it a bit of a difficult investigation, but these complaints can be summarized as follows. The public complained that, number one, there was no legal authority for the expenditure. And even if there was legal authority, the upgrades were excessive and transcended such possible legal authority. Number two, the procurement process was improper. It was in violation of government supply chain management policy framework and resulted in excessive amounts being spent. Number three, the conduct of the president may have been unethical and in violation of the ethics code. That's the first difference between the two, and it clearly emanates from statutory measures, but it also emanates from what it is the public complained and asked the public protector to look into. The second difference relates to the statutory and legal measures, which I already alluded to, Chair, and will not do again. Indeed, in the same detail. The focus this time, however, Chair, will be on specifically, more specific measures around this, that statutory and legal measures that guided the project. Chair, for the public protector, the National Key Points Act and its relevant schedules are the measure against which to judge how this project unfolded and is the measure that she's using to answer those three aspects of complaints by the public. This act establishes that the Minister of Police must sign a National Key Points Declaration and her evidence shows that such a National Key Points Declaration was signed on 8 April 2010. This declaration provided detail of security measures that had to be installed and requested the President to pay for such security measures. The Public Protector deals with this matter on pages 211 to 219 and on page 215 of her report. To illustrate the point of costing, she quotes from the declaration, "The owner slash occupant is responsible for the implementation of this report to ensure that the minimum standard of security is maintained." Close quote. That's on page 250 of her report. The SIU, however, holds a different view. And Chair, these are legal views that, in my position, I cannot say A or nay on these, and I'm not allowed to at all. I will not. But the SIU holds this view that, number one, the upgrades were not installed in terms of the National Key Points Act. Secondly, it holds the view that the Act does not serve as the relevant statutory and legal and regulatory measure in the matter at hand. It makes this point quite succinctly and quite sharply in close to the end of its report. All measures were installed for the SIU in terms of Cabinet Memorandum 2003. That Cabinet Memorandum states very discrete steps that has to be followed, and there are 10 of them. When a project of this nature is started, it starts like this. Number one, the Presidency puts in a request. Secondly, the SA Police Service, specific section of that SA Police Service, does a threat analysis, that is the state security agency of the SAPS. Thirdly, SAPS and the state security agency formulates security measures that they propose. Fourthly, they submit to the Interdepartmental Security Coordinating Committee for their technical assessment that proposed security measure. Fifthly, the Department of Public Works submits a cost estimation for the proposed for the structural measures that encompasses those security measures. The Police Service advise the Minister of Safety and Security of measures and the cost as worked out by the Department of Public Works. And at this stage, Chair, let me just say that it's the professional team of the Department of Public Works, the senior architect, quantity surveyor, structural and civil engineers, and even electrical engineers of the Department of Public Works that does that. Seventh step is that the minister then approves these measures and communicates this to the presidency. The eighth step is that the presidency communicates approved measures to the police service. Ninth step, the police service submits these measures to the Department of Public Works, and the Department of Public Works minister then approves the costs of these structural measures. And only then, Chairperson, does the professional team approach and look at its own roster administration system and sees which contractors and consultants are available to start the process. Chair, related to costing, the Cabinet memo states that the SA Police Service would fund its officials who does these security assessments and all those related costs. But it states that the Department of Public Works is the implementing department and it funds st- structural additions and approved measures from its budget. Chairperson, that is a summary of the commonalities and differences between the public protectors and special investigation units' reports on the security improvements to the president's private residence at Nkandla. It's limited, Chair, because we cannot sit here the whole day and use the members' time for deliberations, Chair. Thanks.
Well, thank you for the presentation. I think it is very useful in terms of the mandate of the committee, because the recommendations that must go to the House must take into account, of course, these different reports as I've indicated. Before I'm going to allow the members to interact on this presentation, I'm going to give the content advisor from police the opportunity just to deal with the issue around the SIU and then where they derive the mandate specifically from and what is the extent especially of work that they can do, and they also venture into making certain recommendations towards the end of their report to Parliament. Just to reflect on those so that we will have an opportunity to interact with it as well.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. Chair, if you read the SIU report, page 2 of that report states that the SIU Act requires the SIU to go beyond investigating. It says to take appropriate steps where such steps shall be justified by evidence to ensure officials are disciplined, persons suspected of criminal offences are prosecuted, and to institute civil proceedings to recover damages or losses that may be suffered by the state. Now, if you look at the legal mandate of the SIU that entitles the SIU to do that, it does go beyond investigations. It recovers money for the state as an institution. The SIU has been established under the Special Tribunals Act of 1794-96, and it's intended to provide for investigating serious malpractices or maladministration in connection with the administration of state institutions, state assets, and public money. It also is intended to investigate any conduct which may seriously harm the interests of the public and of instituting and conducting civil proceedings in any court of law or a special tribunal in its own name on behalf of the state institutions. So the Act provides for that, for such investigations and for recoveries of money. To provide also for the revenue and expenditure of the Special Investigations Unit, to provide for the establishment of special tribunals so as to adjudicate upon civil matters emanating from investigations by the Special Investigations Unit, and to provide for matters incidentally. That is directly quoted from the Act. Some of the key dates was the Act was assented on the 6th of November 1996, commenced in 20th November 1996. The regulations were gazetted on the 14th of March, and it was amended, 2003, and was amended in October 2012. Now, with the establishment of the SIU, according to Section 2, just apologies for my voice, infection. According to Section 2, the President may establish a special investigation unit by proclamation on the following grounds: serious maladministration in connection with the affairs of any state institution, B, improper or unlawful conduct by employees of any state institution, C, unlawful appropriation or expenditure of public money or property, D, unlawful, irregular or unapproved acquisitive act, transaction, measure or practice having a bearing upon state property, E, intentional or negligent loss of public money or damage to public property, F, offence referred to in Part 1 and 4 or Section 1720 or 21 insofar as it relates to the aforementioned offences of Chapter 2 of the Act, of the Prevention of the Combating of Corrupt Activities Act 2004, and which offences which was committed in connection with the affairs of any state institution. G, the unlawful or improper conduct by any person which has caused or may cause serious harm to the interest of the public or in the category thereof. I think that last clause, Chair, relates to anybody that's not an employee of the state.
Can you just hold for me? May I just request that when you take photos that you just switch off the flash, please. I see you've taken a beautiful selfie of yourself at the back, but your flash went the other way. So I don't know what the value of your flash was. And I hope you share that selfie with us. Continue.
Thank you, Chair. Three, the proclamation referred to in subsection 1 must set out the terms of reference of the Special Investigations Unit and such particulars regarding the establishment of the Special Investigations Unit or Special Tribunal as the President may deem necessary. That's what the Act says. 4, the President may at any time amend the proclamation issued by him or in terms of subsection 1. Now, its mandate and function is encapsulated in section 4.1, Chair, and that is A, to investigate all allegations regarding the matters concerned, the matters that we've raised in the preceding section. B, to collect evidence regarding acts or omissions which are relevant to each investigation. So, contrary to other investigations, they actually collect evidence, court-ready evidence, that they can use in the prosecution of such offences. And then they can also see, institute and conduct civil proceedings in a special tribunal or any court of law for one, any relief to which the state institution concerned is entitled, including the recovery of any damages or losses and the prevention of potential damages or losses which may be suffered by such a state institution. And two, any relief relevant to to any investigation. And three, any relief relevant to the interests of the Special Investigations Unit. Sorry. Then to refer evidence regarding or which points to the commission of an offence to the relevant prosecuting authority. So where it does not prosecute, it can refer such matters for prosecution. E, to perform such functions which are not in conflict with the provisions of this Act, as the President may from time to time request. And then F, from time to time, as directed by the President, to report on the progress made in investigations and matters brought before the Special Tribunal concerned or any court of law. So the Special Investigations Unit reports to the President, Chair, even a progress report. G, upon the conclusion of the investigation, to submit the final report to the President. And H, to at least twice a year submit a report to Parliament on the investigations by and the activities, composition and expenditure of such units. So it's accountable to this Parliament. A special investigation unit must, as soon as practicable after it is obtained evidence, referred to in sections 1D, inform the relevant prosecuting authority thereof, whereupon such evidence must be dealt with in a manner which best serves the interests of the Republic. So there's very clear delineation as to what it can and can't do so far. Its powers is encapsulated in Section 5 of the Act, Honourable Chair. It can determine its own procedure for investigations. It can charge and recover fees and expenses from the state institution for investigations and the legal costs for recovery. State institutions can apply if they don't agree with the SIU for exemptions from the PFMA, Public Finance Management Act. It can require any person to provide such particulars and information as may be reasonably necessary. It can order any person to appear before it to produce books, documents, or objects in its possession or his possession. It can administer an oath to or accept an affirmation from any person, chairperson. And in section 5.5 provides, and I think this is the important one, notwithstanding anything to the contrary in any law for the performance of its functions under this Act, a special investigation may institute and conduct civil proceedings in its own name or on behalf of a state institution in a special tribunal or in any court of law. Now, that I think is where this differs with the Public Protector Act in particular, Chair, where they can actually proceed with prosecution, produce the court ready evidence. And then 6A, the relationship with the public prosecutor is also catered for in the Act. It says, upon the establishment of a special investigation unit, the head of such a unit must provide the public protector with a copy of the proclamation referred to in section 2.1. My colleagues have already spoken about the proclamation. B, the head of a special may refer any matter which, in his or her opinion, could best be dealt with the public protector to the public protector and to the public and the public protector may, if he or she deems it appropriate, refer any matter which comes to his or her attention and to which falls within the terms of reference of a special investigation. Now, if you recall, Chair, in the public in the SIU report, clause 25, page 237. They do report, the SIU does report that it was approached by the public protector and to look at bank statements of seven officials and 14 consultants and contractors, which it reported that it did, and it found that there was no evidence of additional deposits into those particular accounts. That's what it did report in the SIU report. Referrals to court, again, section 9, any member of the special investigation unit who is qualified and admitted as an advocate or an attorney, Honourable Chair, may perform such work in a special tribunal or any court of law on behalf of the SIU or the state institution as is by law, custom or practice performed by advocates and attorneys. So the SIU, in terms of what is already been said and what is in the Act, is mandated to investigate and then to gather the evidence and then to assist with the prosecution of these individuals. There are other provisions in the Act, and I'm not ready to go through all the other provisions that are relevant to this particular deliberation, Chair. There are, Section 5 provides for the delegations of powers and functions of the head of the SIU. Section 6 provides for the entering of premises by the SIU and the removal of documents and books and objects. Section 7 then provides for the composition, what is needed for the composition of a special tribunal. Section 8 provides for the powers of such a special tribunal, what they can and can't do. And Section 9 provides for the procedures for evidence. Section 10 provides for the tribunal to be open to the public, and Section 11 provides for regulations. Section 12 then provides for offences and penalties. And then Section 13 to 15 provides for liability and funding of the SIU and the application of the Act to the to commissions of inquiry, where there are such commissions of inquiry. That. So, Chief, if you look at it, the Act in its current form mandates the SIU to do the necessary to recover state money where it's been lost, where it's been obtained in an irregular manner. And I think if you read the SIU report and all the recommendations that they make, what the SIU report does differently is that it lists the individuals that it's investigated and it indicates whether there must be a criminal or a departmental sanction attached to those individuals. So you can see the format that the report is taking is already preparing the ground for court-ready evidence, and that's the difference with the SIU report. Thank you, Chair.
We may thank the two content advisors from Parliament who were assigned to assist the committee during its work. We've got the reports, and there's a few issues that I've noted, but I first want to give an opportunity to the members of the committee to raise matters, to get clarity around certain points, so that we can engage in the discussions. I will now recognize any member who wish to ask a question or want to deal with a specific matter that has been raised. Honorable Kubai, Honorable Maseko, Honorable Biekman, and the Honorable Macheka. In that order, please.
Chairperson, thanks. I think for me, mainly the presentation has really reconfirmed, because going through the report, you have noted most of these issues that they are raising. But what I appreciate more is around the deliberation on the SIU. Its mandate and its responsibility, because that assists, because at times we get to get derailed in what we want to say, or we tend to go into political space and forget about the constitutional mandate of institutions and what they have done. So I think for me, it's not questions, Chair, but just to appreciate that clarity in terms of the role and the importance of SIU and the need for us to continue to appreciate institutions that are fighting corruption and crime within our country. But more again, which I need clarity on, yeah, I think there is one. But there's something that I could have, maybe I heard wrongly. The issue of costs, because it came across as if you're giving to the contractors, giving an impression that the original costs come from the professional team. I'm not so sure if that's what you said. But just to be clear in terms of that process, how the cost came about, because there's something that I had and it was a bit worrying. I didn't pick it up in the reports. Maybe if you can just clarify what are you saying there and what's your position on that one. I'll come back on further the discussion, because I think they've enhanced our discussion from last week in terms of the processes and what needs to happen and where we pick up the issues. And I agree with them, both institutions, the SIU and the Public Protector, derive their mandate differently. But their work can be observed differently because it's to enhance our work as well. But you are able to pick up similarities where they both agree on certain matters where procedures were not followed. You find both of them agree in terms of the procedure that has not been followed, where there's issues of concerns. And I think later when we start going into detail, I hope, Chair, that we go into detail once we have done with the discussions, when we look at some of the issues that they are flagging, their findings, that we are able to systematically, as Parliament Committee, look at those things. What are they saying? How do we pronounce ourselves? How do we find ourselves as Parliament Committee to be able to ensure that there is accountability? Because I think that's what is important. Yeah, I think I'll come back on a number of issues later, Chair, as part of discussion, but I just had those two things for them.
Honourable Maseko.
Thanks very much, Chairperson, and thank you to the two content advisors. I think the clarification and simplification was very useful, and it really now broadens one's horizon and on some of the issues. On the SIU issue, there is a relationship with the Public Protector, with ICU, SIU, the Public Protector and the Special Investigating Unit. They do have a relationship. But then I want to go back to the document in relation to commonalities. If DPW, SANDF, and SAPS staff did not follow the statutory and legal measures, which is the point number one, so what informed these upgrades? If all these units that are supposed to be looking at those issues and based on that, then they then act. What informed these upgrades at the President's House? And on another question will be on page 3 thereof, on the Public Protector responded to complaints from the public. The third one is that the conduct of the President may have been unethical and violation of the ethic code that comes from the public. In which way did then the President violate your understanding? This is what the Public Protector is supposed to be responding to on the complaints from the public. And the NKP, the National Key Point Act, probably if we could get clarified on this act, same as the way we were clarified on SIU, so that we understand where they derive these powers from. And with the act of the SIU, one now understands why they could then institute for legal action that 150 million. The other one on page four on the where it says the SIU holds a different view, and when it comes to the 10 point that directs the cabinet memo, 4.7 says the minister approves measures and communicate this to the president or presidency. Measures, not costs. If I understand it well, so it was measures, not the cost, that was communicated by the minister to the presidency. And then 4.10 is that the DPW minister approves costs of structural measures. So because there were different costs, which cost did the minister approve? The minister of DPW. I will leave it there for now, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
The Honourable Beckman, I hope the content advises you will answer that as far as you possibly can. Okay? I think the member has flagged certain issues which cannot necessarily be responded to in terms of the task that they had at hand. Honourable Beckman.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the submission from the content advisor and the legal advisor. Maybe just to get a sense of the old question, it's also raised in the 10 steps, the question of security measures, non-security measures. I mean, it's also in all the reports, the debate and the question about what is security, non-security. Now, in terms of the 10 steps, you've got the SAPS and the State Security Agency involved doing that job. Now, the question is really, what is the basic level of expertise, also in terms of the MIS maybe, what is the basic expertise expected from the team or individuals who do that specific security analysis, threat analysis? Is there, for instance, a specific training that members should have? Is there certain protocols that they must adhere to? Is it a specialized unit in SAPS or the State Security Agency? Is there certain standards for those members when they do that? Is there, for instance, analysis of that by outside people? And in general, heads of state benchmark, if that specific features are evaluated, is it done by the relevant statutory institutions? What's again the level of expertise? Because if you evaluate the reports and look through it, we as individuals, for instance, will make certain evaluations and submissions, but we don't got that specific expertise, for instance, in the issue of the reasonable man, maybe the reasonable security expert. So if you ask anybody in this room to do evaluation, there will be different perspectives, different situations depending on their training, education, and perspective or life experience. Now my question is really, if you look at that, who made, in terms of making that call, what is the level of expertise and what is that framework that is used to do that? Because that will help us to evaluate maybe the differences as well in the reports on coming to a conclusion whether we can make a valid assumption. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Mocheka.
Honourable Chairperson, I really think that the analysis by the content advisors was very useful, and it has clarified lots of things. For instance, when you come to the violation or otherwise of the Code of Ethics, the finding says conduct of president which may have been unethical. Now, what is the meaning of that? Because one would expect that the idea here is to say there is a violation by the president of the code of conduct. But if it says conduct which may have been unethical, it doesn't say anything. So I think, in my view, that one should be upfront here and say the president has not violated any code of conduct, because the report itself doesn't say so. Now, there's this point about the process for the initiation, the request, the approval of the measures, not costs, and so on. I'm not sure if you are saying that the process requires the president to request, or it is something that is done by virtue of the fact that the president assumes an office, and there is that office, not the individual. The office necessitates a threat analysis, and now the ministers responsible, Minister of Police and the Minister of Public Works, have got to deal with the matter in terms of the outcomes of the threat analysis. And also that when the measures are put before the president, it doesn't seem, and you can assist me, it doesn't seem that the president has powers to veto. It appears that he really notes this sense back, but the decisions are not taken by the president, as I understand it. And so if the decisions are not taken by the president, how can one then attribute any guilt or anything? Because he has just noted that. So I think we, in my view, when we deal with these matters, we must be able to be upfront and say, this is the position or not the position, and that, not let matters hang. There's also something that came out of from the opposition, and an attempt to say the report of the public protector is superior to that of the SIU and others. But from your input, it is quite clear that the SIU derives its powers, like the public protector, from an act of parliament. And now what the president does is simply to implement legislation, and that comes from the constitution, that parliament make laws, the executive implements. So I'm not sure if I understand the matter correctly, that by issuing the proclamation which assigns duties to the SIU, which flows from legislation, you can't, as the opposition say, that the SIU report is therefore an executive report and is inferior to the report of the public protector. So I hope you'll clarify us further on that. The other issue is the way the determination was made whether, for instance, the chicken run, cattle crawl was a security measure seems to have been done arbitrarily, because if these features were already existing, and now in terms of the threat analysis, they had to be moved from one place to another, in terms of that finding. And in the process of doing so, there is enhancement, wrongly or rightly, which enhancement resulted from the actions or omissions of the project managers, how can one then come and say such enhancement constitute an undue benefit to the president? Because if you come to that conclusion would require a determination of guilt on the part of the president. And in my view, it cannot be correct to say an enhancement which was not authorized, which came about as a result of an omission by someone or an error of judgment by someone, constitute guilt on the part of the president, and therefore that the president has something to pay. But in short, I'm really just saying that you have clarified us, and this is very useful. So one says this just to not to call on you to be lawyers or the advisors of the SU or the PIS, but just to emphasize the extent to which you have clarified some of us. Thank you.
I want to give the content advisors just an opportunity, and we'll come back to them, just an opportunity to, where you can, in terms of the two reports that you have dealt with, if you can clarify some of those issues. And other issues really were matters that are flagged by members of the committee that you cannot be reasonably expected to respond to.
Chair, and thank you, Chair. Thanks, members, for the questions. Now, Chair, there are some questions that we will respond to. Others we will we'll share between ourselves. But others we will respectfully, Chair, leave to the committee to deal with and to other staff to deal with, because they could take us into areas that do not fall within our ambit. Chair, just on the question of the costing, the original cost, from the Honourable Kubai. I think there's two aspects to the question if we want to clarify that matter. The first is what the professional team, what we mean by that. The professional team that I mentioned that came up with original cost was the 27 million of the Department of Public Works. Their professional team came up with an initial cost, and they came up with a costing, and it sort of relates to the Honourable Mocheha's question about the Department of Public Works and enhancements. What starts the process? Is it when the President takes office, or is it really the President's request? Your reference to the 10-point. So I'll sort of merge that, but your answer, my response to your answer would unfortunately be slightly diluted. The professional team that I referred to was that of the Department of Public Works' senior architect, the project manager, the senior quantity surveyor. And quantity surveyors are the people who do look at what is needed as far as and structural engineers and electrical engineers. They sit together, they go to the site, look at the site, and make an assessment on structural aspects. In the case of this project, the acting director general, Mr. Solly Malibie, did an inspection at a time when there was no request. He did and in loco inspection with a professional team and came up with that costing. There was no request from the presidency. There was no security assessment, threat analysis done by SAPS. And that fell outside of, and both reports share this. That fell outside of the normal process that Cabinet Memo 2003 expects. It might be preemptive of a public servant to do these things, but one has to follow legal measures. They are there, practice notes of Treasury, etc. All those things are there to guide us so that we do these things properly. So that's why I say, Honorable Moshecha, my answer to yours is sort of hidden in there and a bit diluted, and I apologize for that, but there's a reason why I diluted. I hope I'm answering your question, Honorable Kubai. Because the other aspect, where the confusion can come in, it can come in if we look at the amount of cost that was done, the costing exercise that was done by the private professional team, R&G consultants, who is the quantity surveyor that was principally guided by assessments inside that private professional team, the architect, the quantity surveyor, electrical engineer, structural and civil engineer, on their own, acting with the project manager of Public Works. So Public Works, it's a very interesting trajectory story that we see in both reports of how a department's professional team becomes quieter as the project commences and another team steps in. I think there was a question of one of the members that wanted to know what informed them. I think it was your question, Honorable Maseko. What informed all this costing? It was informed by the private team. I think acting, and I emphasize, Chair, I think acting, and here you can see, Chair, the dilution starts. Acting on their own assessments, but acting based on a specific contract that the principal agent has with the Department of Public Works. And that costing can then be tracked to, and you can see how the project manager would go to the regional office manager, Mr. Hanyile, requesting him at a particular start of a financial year, saying to him, there isn't enough money, there's enough money for where we are now, but for the next financial year, I need so much, based on the private professional team's assessment. So I think I dealt with two or three questions there, Chair. I will leave the issue of the security measures versus non-security measures, the framework that is used for threat analysis, if my colleague can answer that, I will leave that to him. There are some questions, Chairperson, that especially the one on the National Key Points Act, that I would advise, Chair, that the committee requests legal to look at. We can do our summaries of that and our reading of that at another time, but at this stage, we cannot, Chair, look at that and do that justice to an answer to that question. Chair, yeah, that is really my response to those questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I've been in the question that Mr. Buffon raised in terms of the security assessment. Sorry. Chair, when there is a security assessment, the officials, particularly when it comes to the prison, it's the state security agency that takes the lead. The South African Police Services collaborates with the state security agency to do the assessment. Those are the EPIC security agencies that takes the lead. There might be other agencies that are involved. For instance, the South African Defence Force might become involved, National Defence Force might become involved in relation to transporting the president, because they would require certain things, as the report lays out. Internationally, when you're doing a security assessment, your agents must be highly trained to be able to look at an existing premises and then take into account what your needs are in terms of traveling and so forth, your comings and goings, and then make an assessment of what is required. Basically, you must be trained to see the invisible if you're talking about security. What's not visible to us in the public and what's invisible, a good security agent would be able to look at that facility and then be able to make recommendations there. And there is also, for state officials, the minimum information security standards in relation to how they ought to conduct themselves when it comes to dealing with information. Those are not for state security agents only, but for all government officials, really. The recommendations is then taken to the Interdepartmental Security Coordinating Committee that makes a final recommendation on what ought to be approved and what's not approved. Thereafter, that recommendation then goes to DPW, and they must then implement the infrastructural changes. But the security-related changes, for instance, personnel, that then becomes a respective departmental issue, for instance, defense or police or so. So that's all that I want to respond to at this stage. I'm not sure that I can respond to the other questions because it is a bit of a legal nature, and also we wouldn't be staying to that area. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for the responses. There was a follow-up question from the Honourable Mocheka, Honourable Maseko, then the Honourable Ngobo, and the Honourable Jakure. In that order, please.
Now, Chairperson, I correct me if I missed a point, but I seem to understand from the analysis that there was a kind of outsourcing of authority, and now outsourcing authority to the principal agent and his other contractors. Now, if that is so, and the principal agent and his contractors used the authority to enhance the value of what they are now seen by the public protector as non-security measures, on what basis can one come to talk about unjust enrichment by the praises? Because if you are unjustly enriched, it presupposes that there is guilt on your part. But given the scenario that you have painted, you can't link the enhancement and any undue enrichment to a guilt of the president. So I'm just saying that the situation is indeed, even to begin to suggest payment by the president or for anything, it really seems to me absurd. Thank you.
Honourable Maseko.
Thank you, Chairperson. Pardon me if it is not within your scope, I will understand. I just wanted to find out when looking at what the SIU holds as different views is that the upgrades themselves were not installed in terms of the National Key Point Act, and that the National Key Point Act does not serve as a relevant legal framework or statutory framework in this matter of the upgrades of the security measures in the president's homestead, and that all measures were installed in terms of the cabinet memo of 2003. So if that is the basis, in your analysis, what then informed the public protector to use an act that is not relevant to the investigation? Thanks. As I said, that up to you. Thanks. The person.
But allow me also to put it all the same because one of my several covered it. But my angle is as much as the advice. guidance and thinking that people need people to be witness and key points. It is important to raise it at the same time because the public protector took her investigation around the national key points as well as around the department. But the problem here is much as she used the national key points, the documents that are supposed to be available were not available. So that also poses a problem around the key points and the investigation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, if I may be allowed to use my vernacular language, I'll then summarize what I mean by that.
Yes, I'll allow you to do so as long as you... There's no live direct translation services available, so you can do that. But please,
okay,
at the end, just summarize for us what you said in English, please.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. I think the Constitution allows me to do so because it's one of the official languages.
So in the spirit of the Constitution, I will allow you to do so.
Okay. Ngiyabonga ke wena lo sisihlalweni. Ngithanda kubonga ke kulaba bekunene lokuthi basilethele le mbiko njengoba injalo lokuthi ihluke njani, ihlangana njani. Ngoba loku bese kusicaka, uma ngingathi nje kancane ngicacise nje le bekushiwo ngoba bemutherha. Ngithanda kwati nje kulaba bekunene ukuthi ngabe lo msebenzi lo wendiwa i-Special Investigation Unit, ngabe usemthethweni na, njengoba sihleti la sinale report yabo. And labanye balingani bethu labaye basibalekela, labaye bakhuluma ngokuthi i-report libalulekile yinye kuphela. Kodwa kuyo le report yalo, lokuthiwa ibalulekile, uye wathumela letinye tinto ukuthi atiphenywe ngiyo le SIU. So ngifuna kwati ukuthi ngabe isemthethweni na, isebenza ngalokusemthethweni noma njani. Ngiphinde futhi ngithi kafishane, nangabe uta ngaba bemutherha uthi babemutherha utofaka letinto letifanele tiviyele babemutherha njengoba angumongameli walelive. Ufika ukhanza kunesibaya la ekhaya. Sibaya sakhiwe la setinkomo. Lihoka lethu inkukhu ngala. Kunesitolwana lesikhona lapha lesi make mutherha athengisa tinto takhe. Lo mphakathi uyakhona ukuthi ude uzothenga la ekhaya. Uyafika wena uthi letinto adisuke la. Dibe setakhiwa ngala. Udotisusa ngoba titawutsika meta lo msebenzi wakho lo wendawo. Ngabe ngokwathi kwenu kucacisa nje ukuze sikhone ukuvisisa ngoba thina labanye asikhoni kahle ukuvisisa letinye tetinto kungako sitholakala sibuta leti. Ngabe ngibani lekufanele ende lo msebenzi? Thola sibaya samthaka sikhona la ngithatha usuku. Sithengala ngoba sitawutsika meta indodami letinto lengitanato tekuvikela ngisakhile sikhona la ekhaya tonke letinto la ekhaya ngiyasusa mina ngithi babemtherha sibuye ngala babemtherha ngabe nguye lokufanele akhe lesibaya la kufanele sibe khona ngithi wena usolela uthi asisuke nifuna kususa sithengala ngabe babemtherha nguye lokufanele akhe lesibaya noma njani. Umbiko uthi ngaloko kusho ukuthi babemtherha uzuze ngalokungekho emthethweni letinto leto. Sikusho njani lokho ngoba letinto bezikhona? Sisho kanjani ukuthi
se mengameli uzuze ngalokungekho emthethweni ngokuthi lesibaya nje sisuso sakhiwe ngala akakathi mengameli ufuna sibaya sami sisuso ngini lelita ngalete kuvikela nithi nitasusa lesibaya sakhiwe ngala besikhona lesitodlwana nithi sifuna siphume la ekhaya ejamini la ekhaya emabaleni akamungameli sibele ngaphandle ngoba kungena abantu abaningi la ekhaya batothenga lesitodlwana lenkhuluma ngaso ngule tuck shop or spaza shop lekhulunywa ngayo siphinze futhi suka lapho sithi lelo hhoko lethi nkukhu njengoba kunemahhoko ngala kutalela timachanza ngala tinemanjwele ngala kunalo letinto tigcwele lonke leli bala sithi kufanele tisuswe tibuyiswe ngala kube into leyi i-one le nto khona ukuthi kungathikameteki into kuphepha la ekhaya sikusho kanjani ukuthi letinto leto mongameli uzuze ngalokungekho emthethweni kodwa letinto bithi khona so ngitawuthanda ukuthi ngicaciseleke lo so lokunye ngithanda ukubuta nje kafishane ukuthi ngabe kube khona kuhlolwa kahle ngokuthi kube khona abantu labafundzele lo msebenzi wokuthi bahlole kwekuthi ngabe loku lekufanele kutofakwa letinto tekuphepha tamongameli likufanele livikele mengameli la ekhaya ngabe kwendekile loko na nangabe kungendekanga ngisho njengoba nibuka lama reports njengoba nabiswa wabuka sina sesibonile ukuthi kuna kwendekeni kodwa ngifuna nje ucaciselwa ngini ukuthi ngabe kwendeke njani lapho ukuthi kube khona abantu laba bafundisekile kahle ukuthi bafundzele lo msebenzi wokuhlola lethi into ukuthi vele lokhu kunolokufunekako ukuthi kwendeke lo sesihlalweni babe frolike kunala lama reports especially ikakhulukati leya mvikelo wesive ithi kube nekungenelela kakhulu kwalaba labaphethe labasemagunyeni ngisho baphathiswa umphathiswa nelisekela lakhe baye bangenelela kuletinto lethi betendeka lapha kamongameli ngabe letinto leto lesithi siyavuma ukuthi akuhambisani nale ministerial handbook leya lelibhukwana le baphathiswa lelishoko ukuthi kuyini lokuzuzwa ngibo kuyini lokufanele ngingazuzwa ene lelibhukwana lelo lisho kahle kamhlophe ukuthi akufanelanga la baphathiswa basondzele la kuletini sikusho kanjani ngokwenu nje nima advisors kungeni lenesi nizama kusiluleka ukuthi mongameli bekufanele athi ukuthi kwenekani emtini wakhe uma sisho njalo ngabe asitihlangahlanganisi na ngisho le report mayisho njalo ukuthi umongameli bekufanele ngabe ube lo muntu lo athi ukuthi kwenekani kakhe ngaloko bangeke aphule lo mthetho walebhukwana lelo na ngiloko lengicela ukuthi nisicacisele Honorable Chairperson, shortly I was saying that what the Honorable Mutsekga was saying about the cattle crawl, the chicken run, the tuck shop, and all that, those things were there in the President's homestead. Those things were there, in this feature, were there. Then the security... those who are responsible with security said, no, these things must be moved and put this side because like the crawl, everyone was using the very same entrance and the cattle were using the very same entrance. So this crawl must be moved from this side to this side because there will be an obstruction of the security measures around this homestead. And also the chicken crawls and where the chickens were laying eggs and where the chickens were pulled with their chicks, those things were scattered all over the homestead. Then the those people who said these things will obscure the security features, so they must be put somewhere. They decided to build one thing which will be used to put all the where the chickens will lay their eggs, their chicks and everything. So they moved it. The spaza shop also was there. So because people were coming in and out of the president's homestead to buy whatever, because that spaza shop was serving the community, then they decided no, this will be a problem to the security of the president. Then the spaza shop, they decided to build it outside. Then how do we say the president and his family unduly benefited on this one? I just want maybe their understanding in this regard when they compare their reports. Because when you say this thing must be moved to that side, you must be responsible for that. The fact that you enhanced it, you did it, the owner doesn't have a say in those things. You are the one who said this. Then my question also was that, is the SIU, I don't know if this question was raised when I was outside, is the SIU within the work of the SIU, is it within the law of this country that we must have the SIU to do this and this and this? Why am I asking this question? Is that the public protector also referred some matters to be investigated by the SIU. And also the president, when he responded to this report on the within 14 days after it was released, then he made proclamation for the SIU to go further and investigate some matters, which means both the president and the PP's of office are in agreement here that there are specialized areas where we don't have a capacity to investigate this. So those matters were referred to the SIU. So I just want to get your understanding regarding that. Also, on the role of ministers who are mentioned in both reports, that there was interference of both the minister or then minister of public works and the deputy minister. In that regard, when this other report is saying that the president should have known what happened at his homestead, the fact that we are saying that the president should have known each and everything that was happening there, of which the ministerial handbook of 2003 is against it, then are we not contradicting ourselves there to say that the ministers were not supposed to get closer to what was happening there? Then on the other hand, we say the president should have known what was happening. Then for him to know each and everything, to ask, today what are you doing? Yeah, I want this there, or what, or all those things that we expect him to have done. Are we not really are these reports contradicting each other there? What exactly is the ministerial handbook saying? Because from our own understanding, it says ministers must not interfere in anything that is being done at their houses, or the president mustn't interfere. Then we are saying he should have known what was happening. Chairperson, those are the clarities that I want to know. Thanks.
The Honourable Beertman, may I just indicate, Honourable Lakuda, that some of the questions that you've raised were answered whilst you requested to be outside. Also, the issue around the legal authority of the SIU was dealt with. Honourable Beertman?
No, thank you, Chair. Maybe with regard to again the question, and thank you for the responses with regard to the matter of security assessment and the departments that are responsible there for. And also looking at the 10 steps in the cabinet memo, and I mean part of our task as committee is to look at maybe more recommendations. come in with more steps, because it's very concerning. If you look at page 119 of the SIU report on both the SAPS assessment and the SANDF assessment, and the SIU says in paragraph 145, the picture that emerges from this foregoing is this: the totality of requirements that had to be met to ensure the safety of the president was contained in different reports or lists. There was no coordinated effort to determine what all the requirements were. Perhaps most worryingly, no consolidated list had been compiled. In fact, it appears that no such list was compiled by any of the departments, or indeed by the consultants. So, Chair, it's quite clear then, in terms of responsibility, in terms of the security assessment, threat and analysis, coordination, where security really will have to look at maybe additional recommendations. Because if you look at the PP's report as well as the SIU report, although there's recommendations for the various departments, one of the gaps here is the coordination of this whole role of security, and I think that's a matter that we will have to look at going forward. Although we're not there, it's quite clear from this report we'll have to go there.
Honourable Kubai, you will be the last one before we break for lunch, and I'll give the two content advisors where they are in a position to comment, just to comment.
Thanks, Chair. I think for me it's mainly that I wanted to say that we're already getting into the discussions that I don't think that the two gentlemen would be able to get into. But just to say, because I would want us to get into the situation where we start debating and discussing the issues that have been raised. For example, you find that what they are flagging for us, I don't have questions for them, but what they are flagging for us is that the two reports or the two institutions are deriving, or I expect, for example, the PP says that the project was done under the National Key Points Act. The SIU report says that the project was done under Cabinet Zemo in terms of the steps. So I would want us to get into the space where we start looking at these issues intensively as the committee, to be able to look at what could have been the issues. I mean, for example, I would disagree with SIU, where they speak about the issue that it needed, that the president needed to have, because according to the SIU and the steps that to be followed, it means that the president or the presidency should request the process. Whereas in terms of other processes or in terms of the legal framework and how SAPS and SNDF operates, we didn't have to wait. They would have to say based on the assessment. So there are certain things that really we've got to look at from our side as members of parliament, but as also if there are policy gaps that we need to start looking at and saying, what are the gaps that we are identifying and therefore that needs to be addressed. I'm a bit cautious because I don't want to dwell into what you want us to go into the after lunch, Chair, but I just found that there are certain things that are coming strongly for me on the comparison and which falls within the ambit of us as legislators.
Hold on to those things. May I just, before they respond, indicate, Honourable Maseko, that if you look at page 427 of the Public Protector report, you raise the issue as to why the Public Protector refers to the National Key Points Act. In 10.1.3, the Public Protector indicates, and I quote, "With the National Key Points Act having been inexplicably dragged in halfway through the implementation of the Nkanta project, its provisions had to be complied with." This did not happen. That's the view that she's putting across in terms of the findings. Can you make some remarks just before we break for lunch, please?
Chair, when you refer to that one, Chair, you almost answered and clarified some of what I wanted to clarify. But there's another point, Chair, that I think we must just add to that specific issue of the National Key Point Act. And that is the reliance on the National Key Points Act is with a specific focus on cost, on the matter of complexity that they raised at the beginning of cost as a matter of complexity that this committee needs to look at. And so it's with that in mind, we need to look at NKP only as the issue of cost, and where it is brought in and for what reason it's being brought in. Just Chair, another point of clarity that I think is important is the matter of the 10 steps that I referred to the end of my presentation. These 10 steps do not derive from myself or from the SIU or from the public protector. It actually comes from a discussion of cabinet in 2003. So it's a cabinet memorandum. And it's a cabinet memorandum that, because it comes from cabinet, these are steps that has to be followed. And these steps must be followed with the Public Finance Management Act, with the supply chain management of the Department of Public Works, and with other measures such as the ministerial handbook. That's the one point of clarity, Chair, that needs to be made. But just to go to the issue of the president or the presidency, because that's the office through which the president functions in matters like this. It is at step 7, Chair, of these 10 steps from the cabinet memorandum, where the Minister of Safety and Security, the measures, those security measures, are the security measures that would have determined that certain structures at the private residence constitute dangers in case of emergency measures. And so it's the State Security Agency's threat analysis that's communicated to the President at a particular stage by that particular minister. And that, we must note that when the minister approves these measures, because I think one of the members wanted to know what are these measures. Those are the security measures. So that's one aspect clarified. But then there's another question that arose in deliberations of, so where does the president or the presidency come in when it comes to these measures? Does the president have any say in these measures? Chair, the cabinet memorandum is not clear. The cabinet memorandum doesn't say the president may or may not. But between step 7 and 8, the Minister of Safety and Security approves the measures and the cost and communicates this to the presidency. And then in 8, Chair, the presidency communicates approved measures to SAPS. Nowhere does it say the president may or may not. So that's something that the committee may need to get clarity on. But that is that matter clarified. Just, Chair, on the issue of alleged interference by ministers, the Public Finance Management Act is very clear on these issues. The executive authority does not interfere in the accounting authority. Those are two aspects, two concepts to keep in mind. The Director General is the chief accounting officer, and therefore the Director General, from the Director General down, they are responsible for the budget and the programs of that department and for specific measures such as your supply chain supply chain management measures to be followed. The executive authority does not involve themselves in that. That's why I'm saying those are alleged involvements of those ministers and the deputy minister that's referred to in both reports. And we can look at those both reports. Remember, both institutions or state, both the Public Protector's Office as well as the SIU, These reports are based on investigations and exhausting long interviews with people, as well as combing through documents. And one can look at those findings. At the end of it, it remains alleged interference. Chair, I try to cover as much as possible, but members can always call us to order to give more clarity. Thank you.
Just to add for information purposes, I won't be long. I agree.
Please don't be.
Chair, one must just take into account in terms of what Honourable Buchan raised, the policy gaps that are there with security agencies. You have to take into account that security agencies jealously guard their territory. And that sometimes causes problems because they don't share information with one another and so forth. I think the intention of the legislation here is to get people to work together, and maybe that is a real policy gap. Who takes the ultimate responsibility, and what are the other agencies' role in accounting to one agency? So that is a real policy gap that must be dealt with.
Now, we are going to break for lunch now, but it's just one issue that consistently comes up in front of the discussions, is the issue of who does the determination in terms of what is appropriate state security processes to be followed when securing the residences of the president, members of the executive, and so forth. And unless I'm wrong, you can clarify it with me after lunch, is that in both reports, I do not see, even in the final determination of security and non-security items, the presence of that relevant state security arm in determining what is security and non-security. In fact, in one report, I think it's of the public protector, it refers to work done and costing done by R&G consultants, that was also involved in the project. Later did the determination of what is security and non-security. Am I correct? We'll discuss the matter after lunch. We'll adjourn now for lunch, and we will come back at, it's now 1:10. We'll start at 2:15. Lunch is being served for everyone present here in the Marks Building restaurant, and you are invited to attend. Thank you. Honourable members, you know we are in recess. You are supposed to be in your constituencies. So there's only one restaurant open, which is the Marks Building. If it's too far, then I guess you'll have to skip.